The following recording from the LA Sound Posse contains a keynote speech given by Professor Andrea Smith with a brief introduction by Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. It was recorded by Wally James at the Historians Against War conference held at the University of Texas at Austin on February 17th of 2006. Wally James introduced this recording on his show, The Progressive Forum, on March 9th, 2006. Progressive Forum airs on KPFT in Houston, Texas.
All right. Up next, we have a speech. This is author and activist Andrea Smith. She spoke at the Historians Against War conference in Austin on February 17th, and she's introduced by Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz.
Well, I have the great honor of introducing Professor Andrea Smith. Andrea Smith is a co-founder of Insight Women of Color Against Violence and the Boarding School Healing Project. She was also a co-founder of the Chicago chapter of the Women of All Red Nations. She is author of Conquest, Sexual Violence, and American Indian Genocide, which is available for sale out in the lobby, and a co-editor of The Color of Violence. Violence Against Women of Color, which is due out this August with South End Press, is not available here, but will be available in August. She's currently an assistant professor of Native American Studies and Women's Studies at the University of Michigan. Just a personal note, Andrea Smith and I met at the World Conference Against Racism in Durban, South Africa, which ended one day before 9/11 in 2001. And I have never seen anyone who is a better organizer and harder worker and deeper intellectual than Andrea Smith. She's one of my great personal heroes, and I'm really pleased that she can be with us tonight. Thank you, Andrea.
Thank you very much for that very kind and completely undeserved introduction. And also I want to thank the Historians Against the War for organizing this event. And I would like to also acknowledge the indigenous peoples of this land whose absence enables our presence today. Before I begin, I have a confession, which is that I'm not a historian. So instead today, I'm going to have to speak from where I come from, which is indigenous women's and women of color organizing against the war. And in particular, I want to focus on what I see as the theory that's being produced from this organizing so that we're not under the misperception that only academics are theorizing about our current conditions, but activists on the ground also have important theories to inform our work. And I want to focus on women of color organizing in particular because I think it's very significant and yet it's kind of falling under the radar. So a lot of people aren't seeing the importance of it, but I think we may see the fruits of this labor in the future that might have a truly transformative effect. So much of this work came out of the anti-violence movement, particularly when folks became very disturbed after 9/11, when many mainstream feminist organizations actually supported Bush's bombing of Afghanistan because this was going to liberate the women from the repressive policies of the Taliban, because apparently if you throw bombs on women, it will liberate them. So, but nevertheless, kind of this position, it was what was consistent with the position that had been adopted by the anti-violence movement, which was that the state could somehow be the protector of women's freedom. So, for instance, the anti-violence movement had put all of its energies into one strategy for ending domestic and sexual violence, which was supporting the criminal justice system. Through the Violence Against Women Act, all these federal monies went into anti-violence agencies, which in turn invested themselves in calling for more police involvement, longer prison sentences, etc. And the notion was that state violence in the form of the criminal justice system was going to somehow protect women from domestic violence and sexual violence. The problematic assumption of this was that when we look at what was very disturbing to many people after 9/11 was the idea that somehow our notion of home and safety at home had been disrupted. There was the idea that terrorism happens somewhere out there, but our home is supposed to be a safe place. And yet what the anti-violence movement has always contributed to our analysis is that, in fact, it's our home where we're most likely to be in danger of violence. And in addition to that, the notion that the real threat comes from a stranger somewhere out there stops us from seeing that the perpetrator most likely to hurt us is somebody in our own home. And similarly, the notion that terrorism happens somewhere out there stops us from seeing that the U.S. is, in fact, a country built on genocide, white supremacy, and violence against people. But nevertheless, while the anti-violence movement have contributed to this important analysis, all its strategies devoted to ending violence were really based on the notion that the person we had to worry about was someone out there. And that's why it made sense from that perspective to invest in the criminal justice system, because that approach would make sense if what we needed to do was lock up a few wacko men. But when we have surveys in which half of the men say they would rape somebody if they thought they could get away with it, we would either have to arrest half the male population, which some may argue, but in reality is not feasible. So consequently, if we wanted a strategy that would transform a rape culture, we needed a different approach. So women of color argued that we needed to develop an analysis that looked at the intersections of state violence and interpersonal violence. Particularly, we saw this when we put Native women in the center of our analysis, because we see that it's through sexual violence that colonialism has been successful. That is, genocide is a process by which Indian people are not just killed, but by which colonizers attempt to kill our sense of even being a people. And in this process, Native peoples become seen as inherently impure and as a pollution from which the larger colonial body must always cleanse itself. To give an example of this, we can look at an Ivory soap commercial. And with a cartoonish figure of an Indian man and woman, this was the slogan that went with the commercial. It says, "We were once factious, fierce and wild, in peaceful arts unreconciled. Our blankets smeared with grease and stains from buffalo meat and settlers' veins. Through summer's dust and heat content, from moon to moon unwashed we went. But ivory soap came like a ray of light across our darkened way. And now we're civil, kind, and good, and keep the laws as people should. We wear our linen, lawn, and lace, as well as folks with paler face. And now I take, wherever we go, this cake of ivory soap to show what civilized my squaw and me and made us clean and fair to see." So, of course, the joke of this ad is that because Indian bodies can never be clean, white, they can never be clean. And in a patriarchal worldview, only the rape of bodies that are seen as pure count. So, for instance, the rape of sex workers is nothing anybody takes seriously, because sex workers are seen as inherently impure and hence inherently violable and rapable. And similarly, with the logic of genocide, colonialism has rendered native bodies as inherently violable and, by extension, our lands inherently invadable. So therefore, when we look at the history of native genocide, we see that sexual violence has been the primary strategy of the state, and it is quite unlikely then that the state is going to be the solution to ending violence within our communities. So consequently, women of color started to organize around a different approach to ending violence that would look at the links between gender violence and state violence. And they looked to approaches of community accountability in which we would start to end violence in our communities without relying on the criminal justice system. So I just want to give a couple of models just to illustrate what's going on now. One such group is Communities Against Rape and Abuse, which held a prison abolition film festival as an anti-rape organization. And this was the promotional material that they put out. They said, "Any movement seeking to end violence will fail if its strategy supports and helps sustain the prison industrial complex. Prisons, policing, the death penalty, the war on terror, all increase rape, beatings, oppression, and death. As an anti-rape organization, we cannot support the funneling of resources into the criminal justice system to punish rapists and batterers, as this does not end violence. It only supports the same violence that views incarceration as a solution to complex social problems like rape and abuse. As survivors of rape and domestic violence, we will not let the anti-violence movement be further co-opted to support the mass criminalization of young people, immigrants and refugees, and the dehumanization of poor people, people of color, and people with disabilities. We support the anti-rape movement that builds sustainable communities on a foundation of safety, support, self-determination, and accountability. Another group in Brooklyn, New York, Sister to Sister, which is comprised of young women of color ages 13 and 18, decided to declare their area an autonomous zone, and they called it Sister Liberated Ground. So instead of calling 911, essentially you call them. They've developed their own responses to violence using street theater, house visits, interventions, etc. They also started documenting police brutality against a young woman of color in their neighborhood and then showed a film on it on the walls of the police station itself. So these are just a few of the models that people are working with. However, as this work started to develop, people realized that these community accountability models have more radical implications. And that happened in particular with the influence of indigenous people's theories about nationalism and sovereignty. That is, if you think about the criminal justice system, it's really the extension of a nation-state form of governance that's based on domination and control. So if you're trying to think of a world without prisons, then you have to think about, is there a whole different form of governance that we need that's not based on violence? And this is where we turn to Native peoples who are arguing that there's an alternative vision that they can articulate around sovereignty in which we would separate nation from nation state, and hence argue that an international struggle does not have to have as its end goal a nation-state form of governance in which the elites rule everybody else through domination and coercion. But we can instead be informed by indigenous models of governance that are based on mutual responsibility and respect and an understanding that we are part of a larger global world that we need to tend to. And in addition, we can rethink nation as not being about this ethnic cleansing, we're in, you're out, screw the rest of the world, but it's about being open in an inclusive way and sharing our responsibilities to keep to maintain the world in a positive manner. So to give some theories about this that have been articulated by Native women activists, Crystal Echohawk describes it as, sovereignty is an active living process within this knot of human, material, and spiritual relationships bound together by mutual responsibilities and obligations. And Ingrid Wushinawatok argued that, quote, while sovereignty is alive and invested in the reality of every living thing for Native folks, Europeans relegated sovereignty to only one realm of life and existence, authority, supremacy, and dominion. In the indigenous realm, sovereignty encompasses responsibility, reciprocity, the land, life, and much more. And Sammy Tanita helps explain this by differentiating what she calls nationalism versus sovereignty. She says nationalism is saying, and she's talking about Native nationalism here, nationalism is saying our way is the only right way. But I think sovereignty is an acceptance of who and what's around you, and a nationalist doesn't accept that. Sovereignty is what you do and what you are with your own people, but there is a realization and acceptance there that there are others around you. And that happened even before Europeans came. We knew about the Indians, and we had alliances with some and fights with others, but part of the sovereignty was the acceptance that they were there. And I think it's very interesting that sometimes when we talk about sovereignty struggles, that the first question many non-Native people say is, are you saying we all have to go back to Europe or whatever? But the model that's being articulated, say, by Lakota Hardin is a much more inclusive vision. She describes sovereignty as about being for freedom for all people. She says, if it doesn't work for one of us, it doesn't work for any of us. The definition of sovereignty means that none of us are free unless all of us are free. We can't, we won't turn anybody away. How could we ever leave anyone behind? So with these theories, and also particularly as it's being operationalized in Latin America, actually, I'm going to stop there. I've lost my place. Hold on, just one second. Now, in addition to this is, I think, having a gendered perspective on nationalism and the nation state, because what becomes clear is that the building block of a nation state is the heteropatriarchal family. And to elucidate this connection, we should turn to the Christian right. Charles Colson, with Prison Fellowship, explains this very clearly, as he explains why same-sex marriage leads to terrorism. Says, marriage is the traditional building block of human society, intended both to unite couples and bring children into the world. There is a natural moral order for the family. It is not a private institution designed solely for the individual gratification of its participants. If we fail to enact a federal marriage amendment, we can expect not just more family breakdown, but more criminals behind bars and more chaos in the streets. It's like handing moral weapons of mass destruction to those who would use America's decadence to recruit more snipers and hijackers and suicide bombers. And when radical Islamists see news coverage of same-sex couples being married in U.S. towns, we make our kind of freedom aberrant. We must preserve traditional marriage in order to protect the United States from those who would use our depravity to destroy us. And providing further information on this connection was a World magazine which explained that the cause of the Abu Ghraib scandal was feminism. The reason is that because when women do not know their assigned role in the gender hierarchy, they will join the military and become disoriented and abuse prisoners. So, thus, as Anne Berlain argues in Lift High the Cross, it may be a mistake to argue that the goal of the Christian right is to create a theocracy in the U.S. She argues that the Christian right politics is operating through the private family, which is coded as white, patriarchal, and middle class, to create a, quote, Christian America. And she notes that this investment in the private family makes it difficult for people to invest in more public forms of social connection, and that this investment in the suburban private family serves to mask the public disinvestment in urban areas that makes the suburban lifestyle possible, and that the social decay that results is then construed as the result of deviance from the Christian family ideal rather than as the result of political and economic forces. She says, quote, the family is no mere metaphor, but a crucial technology by which modern power is produced and exercised. Now, as Jennifer Dennett-Dale and other Native activists argue, unfortunately, the response to kind of this heteropatriarchal Christian nationalism is often an equally heteronormative Native or racial justice nationalism. But what these women of color theorists are saying, however, is that any liberatory struggle that does not challenge heteropatriarchy cannot substantially challenge colonialism or white supremacy, because Charles Colson is correct that the colonial world order does depend on heteropatriarchy. Just as the patriarchs rule the family and police anybody who does not follow their gender roles, so too does a nation-state form of governance rely on elites ruling everybody else and excluding those who are not properly members of the nation. So therefore, if we want a different model of organizing that does not have the heteropatriarchal family, we then start to construe a different model of liberation that's not based on a nation-state form of governance. And this is what Native women are arguing, what are alternative forms of sovereignty that we can begin to organize for. The next thing that's happening in this organizing is rethinking what we think racial justice organizing is, particularly, quote, people of color politics. I have drawn a diagram of the current model, which you can't see, but the current model that we see with people of color organizing is it's like basically a Venn diagram. There's Latinas, Native Americans, African Americans, etc., and where we overlap is our common victimization, and this is supposed to be the basis of our organizing. This model has not really worked out well because we're not necessarily oppressed in the same way, so in many cases, the strategies that one group comes up with may directly conflict with the liberation goals of another group. So consequently, through a variety of conflicts, particularly, for instance, in the conflicts between Native peoples and African Americans over the meaning of reparations, folks are theorizing about a different way to articulate racial justice organizing, which is in this diagram, which is the three pillars of white supremacy. So the idea of this model is that white supremacy does not operate in a singular way, but has distinct and yet related logics. The first logic is a logic of slavery. That is, this is the logic that sees black people as inherently property. And it is the racial logic that keeps capitalism in place. That is, capitalism makes everybody property. It makes everybody a commodity. But the logic of slavery puts a racial hierarchy on this so that people on the top end of the hierarchy can be in denial about the fact that they could actually escape this commodifying logic of capitalism. The next logic is the logic of genocide, which says that it's basically the job of indigenous peoples to be disappearing. And because we are always disappearing, this entitles non-native peoples to say that they are the inheritors of indigeneity and hence have rightful ownership over this land. As such, it then becomes the anchor for colonialism. Then the next logic is a logic of Orientalism, and I mean this in a broader sense. I'm not specifying this to quote the Orient or Asia. But it's the logic that sees some peoples as civilizations, like they're not property, they're not disappeared, but they're always lesser civilizations, and they're always a permanent threat to the well-being of U.S. empire, for which the U.S. must always be fighting against. And it's the logic that justifies these other two logics because it allows U.S. to be strong enough to always be at war. And consequently, this logic of Orientalism is the anchor for war. In fact, as Sora Hans says, instead of seeing the U.S. as being at war, we should see the U.S. as war. So with this, then, challenges the way we think about coalition building, because where we're organizing is not just where we're commonly oppressed, but instead we're making strategic alliances based on where we are in the political economy with other peoples who are oppressed in different ways. And this also changes our organizing focus from where we are oppressed to the fact that we must always organize around where we are both oppressed and also complicit in the oppression of others, because the seduction of this system is that you are told that if you stay in your place, you will get to take part in the other pillars of white supremacy. So what, for instance, what is the one escape Native peoples are promised for survival? Join the military and take part in Orientalist wars against the permanent foreign threat that against U.S. empire. So again, it changes our organizing strategy from always being a dual strategy of where we are oppressed, but also where we are complicit in the oppression of others. So with this, then, we think about what are the operationalized models based on these theories. And what we are learning, what is happening in the U.S. is that people are starting to learn from the models in Latin America, and there's this cross-fertilization process happening where people are organizing around the model of taking power and making power. That is, taking power is about kind of challenging the powers that be in a direct way, and that will always have to happen. But the concept of making power is the idea that it's not just important to fight against things, but we need to start to create the world we want to live in now. Because otherwise, if we just try to fight the powers that be, our structures that we come up with tend to replicate the thing we were trying to get rid of. And what we were told by people in Latin America is they said, we were formerly organizing around, they called a machismo-Leninismo model. They said where the idea that the vanguard would take control, you know, take up the arms, fight for state power, etc. But they said this model was limited in that, one, people were replicating the same hierarchical structures they wanted to get rid of, and two, it wasn't inclusive enough to engage millions of people in a broad-based movement for change. In addition, when we talked to people from Chiapas, they said originally we had the idea we could just take up arms, but then it didn't really make sense because the powers that be have all the guns. We can't fight them in a military way because we are outnumbered. However, what if we start to create our own governance structures that's not based on violence and domination? And what if we start to do our own health care, our own education system? But most importantly, what if we start to proliferate these autonomous zones? What if they start to grow and grow and grow? Eventually, we'll have a country that's ungovernable by the current nation-state system because we are governing ourselves just fine. And we are starting to see the effects of this work with all the revolutions that are currently going on in Latin America that are based on these models of making power. And similarly, groups in the U.S., too, are starting to build their own autonomous zones with the idea that this work will not the fruits of this work will not be seen in the near future. However, if we slowly start to build our base, eventually we can transform the U.S. itself, too. However, how can we do this? Well, the current problem we have in the U.S. is the nonprofit industrial complex. So what is and I'll define the nonprofit industrial complex. Dylan Rodriguez calls it as, quote, the set of symbiotic relationships that link together political and financial technologies of state and owning class control and surveillance over public political ideology, including and especially emergent progressive and leftist social movements. The nonprofit industrial complex is the natural corollary to the prison industrial complex, and that while the prison industrial complex overtly oppresses dissent, the nonprofit industrial complex manages and controls dissent through incorporating it into the state apparatus. In addition to this, one of the problems that has happened by putting all our organizing within the nonprofit system, instead of focusing on developing our base that would be the base that funds us, we get our salaries paid through foundations, and hence we have no incentive to build a base. And in addition, we become accountable to foundations rather than to the base that we supposedly are representing. So what groups now today are starting to do is figure out how can we organize outside the nonprofit system. This does not necessarily mean getting rid of all nonprofits, but what we've learned from other models in the world is that other people have nonprofits, but they don't equate the nonprofits with the movement. In other words, it's important to develop an independent movement that's independently funded. And if you want to set up a nonprofit to fund a specific activity, that's fine, but the nonprofit answers to the movement. It's not seen as the movement itself. And I think this is a way for us in the academic industrial complex to also think about how to make our work more effective. That is, instead of just thinking cool, groovy thoughts, how can we have a foot in independent movement building that we are answerable to and accountable to? And sure, we need a day job, we need to pay the bills, but our work within the academic industrial complex will be slightly less co-opted if we have to be accountable not to just to tenure committees, but to mass-based movements for social change. In addition to this, I think academics like to whine about how they're so busy all the time because they have to write too many papers and they can't do any organizing. And of course, the problem with this is that everybody's busy, so if we're going to build a movement around non-busy people, we have two people do all the work. So therefore, however, if we think outside the nonprofit system, which is really based on the idea of career activists who are going to devote 80 hours a week to the work, if we think outside that model, then we think of a different form of organizing that starts to include us in our everyday life. We don't have to go somewhere to do organizing. Instead, we think of an inclusive model that's based on where we already are. With that, we may not therefore be able to donate 20 hours to organizing, but maybe we can do a half an hour a week. But if millions of people did half an hour, that would really transform the system. So with that, then, also, and I would also mention, I think that this would also help with our battles within the academic industrial complex, because if we were to sit back and say, what is our model of a liberatory educational system? Would it really be this? I mean, the whole university system is based on the idea that knowledge is a commodity that can be bought and sold on the academic marketplace. So if we really wanted a non-capitalist model for education that was based in community where you didn't have to go someplace to get educated, I think we would have a radically different vision of what a liberatory educational system could be like. And if we put some energy into developing an independent educational movement for liberation, we would have a stronger base of power to deal with the powers that be in the academic industrial complex. So with that, then becomes the fact that we're a little bit depressed because Bush keeps winning. So, however, I think that we have to look beyond this and not get as depressed as we think that we should be. Here I think we can be informed by, again, indigenous models of organizing, which we call the Cowboy and Indians Coalition. What happens is in Indian country, when you have to deal with an issue, you find that you're not in an urban area surrounded by cool multicultural coalitions, and you're surrounded by white people who hate you, and yet this is the only people you have to work with. So therefore, what Native peoples have done is not get depressed, but figure out how to frame issues differently to get people who would seem to be their enemies on their side. Because as one Native activist calls it, if you have an us versus them attitude, you unite them against you. And yet, by having this strategy of reframing issues, Native peoples have had some of the biggest victories against huge multinational corporations, such as the battle against Exxon in northern Wisconsin and the battle against Kerr-McGee in Oklahoma. These battles were won by handfuls of Native activists who were strategic in their alliance building and were able to get people who would not seem to support Native peoples on their side to win these huge victories. Similarly, I would argue, when we looked at the 2004 election, everybody said, oh, well, all is lost. The Christian right has taken over the planet. For instance, Katha Pollitt argued at the time, quote, if a voter wants Christian jihad, he may not be willing to desert the cause for health insurance, especially with Republicans telling him 50 times a day that the plan is really a socialist plot to raise his taxes and poison him with Canadian drugs. Now, well, this is, you know, people are very sympathetic to, I think that this analysis doesn't look beneath the surface because, interestingly, I was reading the Christian right magazines before the elections and they were actually flooded with anti-Bush letters. So just to give you a few examples, these are conservative Republican Christian magazines. This is the letters that they received, quote, I pray for President Bush and admire a clear moral vision grounded in Christian faith. But what are we to think when the outcome of that vision entails so much violence, and when it just so happens that it enriches his party's benefactors at places like Bechtel and Halliburton, and when the target of our latest selective liberation has oil, and when it buries other needs under a landslide of military spending and mounting debt, and when dissenting people and nations are bullied? Either this vision suffers from massive moral blind spots, or the administration is using God talk to manipulate people for ungodly purposes. And two more quotes. Here's the next one. I pray for our servicemen, and I agree that they are brave, but how does their service defend democracy or end terrorism? I don't think you can come to that conclusion without a PhD in convolution. I suppose it helps to have the faith of George W. Bush. He can invade a nation and say it was somehow a just act of war. I just don't see how Jesus Christ fits into all of this. And then finally, Charisma is shocked at how Christians wrote angry letters about Bush. I am shocked that there are Christians who think Bush really is a Christian. So while these malcontents were not mobilized by progressives to impact the elections, potentially they could be if we started to think broader about who our allies could be. And I think it's important to realize that the relationship between evangelicalism and the Republican Party has not always been there. It's part of a 50-year conscious organizing effort on the part of the Republican Party to make this connection. And therefore, it implies that this connection could be rearticulated into a different form of politics. Now, I think it's, again, it's very easy to get overwhelmed with what seems to be like the amazing odds against us. And whenever I get too depressed, I think of my nephew, who about 6 years ago, he was hit by a car and his head was severed from his spinal cord. And at the time, he was given less than a 1% chance of survival. And if he survived, he was given a 0% chance of ever being anything more than a vegetable. Yet despite the odds against him, he and my sister fought for his life, and today he's in school, and he's doing his best to fight the good fight. And in fact, when he was told to do a diorama of the things that are important to him, he put in a picture of himself in a wheelchair rolling over George Bush. So he is alive today because he saw the odds against him and chose to fight anyway. And when I think of the history of Native peoples, I think the only reason any of us are alive today is because the people who came before us saw the odds against them, saw this genocide being perpetrated against them, and they chose to fight anyway. So how could we ever do anything less for the people who are going to come before us? Now, today we might get depressed because we might feel in the elections we did the best we could, but we lost. But I think we haven't even begun to fight. I think if we commit ourselves to the slow work of base building and making power, the fruits of our labor may not be seen immediately, but if we organize for the next 50 years rather than just the next election, we can really hope to see major change in our world today. And I'll just end with a quote from a Native activist who says, "You can't win a revolution on your own, and we are about nothing less than a revolution. Anything else is just not worth our time." Thank you.
That was a speech by Andrea Smith, and she spoke at the UT in Austin at the Historians Against War Conference. That was on February 17th. And to listen to this or any of the other programs here on KPFT, you can go to kpftx.org.
You have been listening to Professor Andrea Smith as she addressed the Historians Against War Conference held at the University of Texas at Austin on February 17th of 2006. The recording was made by Wally James and aired on his show, The Progressive Forum, on KPFT in Houston, Texas.
This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We use the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-alike 2.5 license to ensure the ongoing public availability of these recordings. We share them via the Internet, community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots, social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard in this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic, civic media.